In an article that was published about 35 years ago, my teacher, the late Professor Isidore Twersky, made the observation that in order for Judaism to function, it has to maintain a balance between two separate and ostensibly disparate factors. One is law, Shemiras Mitzvahs, punctilious observance of the law. But of equal importance is the development of one's inner spiritual life. And that inner spiritual life and experience is what vivifies, contextualizes, and deepens and gives meaning to strictly halachic observance. One cannot live, one cannot exist without the other. It was not long after he published that article, and he devoted most of his academic career to that, to the pursuit of that theme, that I realized, as these things happen, totally unexpectedly, that in fact that insight originated with his father-in-law, Mori Varabi, Rav Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. One of the ironies, I think, of the study of the Rav's thought, certainly as more and more of his writings have been published, is that it is still true that most people think of him and think of his major focus as being upon pure philosophy and pure lumdus. When in fact, most of, and I learned with Rav for 9.5 years, most of his efforts, certainly in terms of public teaching, from the late 50s until the time of his retirement, was devoted to the idea that one must not only cultivate halachic observance and strict halachic observance, but it's more important, or equally important, I should say, to cultivate the inner experience of the law. The content, the emotionality, not just praying, but davening. And in fact, the Rav was very prescient in this regard, because as we all know, over the past 15, 20 years, there's been a tremendous upsurge of interest in the development of internal spirituality. If you go into Sfarim stores, you will find far more books, both in English and in Hebrew, that are devoted to the idea of how does one develop an intimate and emotionally laden and powerful relationship with God, relationship with the inner meaning of mitzvahs, than one would have found, say, when I was a student some 30 years ago. One of the ways of doing so, which is not often developed, is by looking back in order to see how generations past experienced their mitzvahs. What I'd like to do with you this morning is to travel back approximately 1,000 years or 800 years to look how and examine how, in fact, Rashi and Tosfos, in classical Ashkenaz in the 11th, 12th, and 13th century, in northern France and Germany, what they felt when they went into shul, how they viewed the shul, how they experienced tefillah. So you'll ask, you know, the truth of the matter is, when a person is spiritual, spirituality is very, very, it's like love, it's very individual. So where do you, how can you reconstruct it? How can you get into the, not just the head, but also the hearts of people who lived 1,000 years ago? So the answer is, as I hope to show you, by very, very carefully looking at hints that are scattered in all kinds of different places throughout the literature that they left. And I hope that when we're finished, you'll have an appreciation of another way of experiencing shul, of experiencing tefillah, of experiencing the presence of the Ribbono Shel Olam. I have to just ask with somebody. I picked up the wrong set of sources, not mine. So if somebody can, please get another set. Okay. I would like to basically answer or try to answer two questions. What is a shul, and who lives there? It seems very simple. And of course, if it works well, then everybody will have what to say at the Shabbos table on this coming Parsha, because this coming Shabbos, because of course next Shabbos we read Parsha Struma, and the Parsha opens with the injunction of God to Moses, Daber al Bnei Yisrael v'yikhuli Truma. Why do you give Truma? Vasuli Mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham. Make me a sanctuary, and I shall dwell within them. So I want to find out what's the sanctuary, and what does it mean, v'shachanti b'tocham. In order to do that, we have to actually start not with that pasuk, but actually with a pasuk in Yechezkel, and it's verse number one, source number one on your sheet. Yechezkel perik yud aleph pasuk tet zayin. Lachen ko amar Hashem Elokim ki hirchaktim bagoyim v'chi yafitzosim baratzos. Says, even though I have caused the Jews, I've scattered them all over the world, they've made it all the way to Afghanistan, we know that, as far as you can go, nevertheless, as far as they may be from Israel, nevertheless, I will be for them as a lesser sanctuary in those countries into which they have come. The simple interpretation of the verse means that God will allow His presence to be there, and He will envelop them in sanctity. His presence will accompany them. We all know, in fact, the Chazal emphasized on many occasions that kol makom shegalu Yisrael shechina imahem, that the divine presence accompanied the Jews wherever they went. And in fact, the shechina is kivayochel in exile so long as the Jews are in exile. Okay, that's the simple pshat, and all of the major pashtanim, the biblical commentators in Spain, where the simple meaning, the straightforward meaning, it's not simple, the straightforward meaning of the verses were presented. That's how they interpret the pasuk. However, that's not how it was interpreted by Chazal. Certainly not in the early in Eretz Yisrael. Take a look, Rashi. I was trying to save paper because we have to be green. Rashi quotes his version, or maybe his interpretation of the Targum of Targum Imkulis, and he says as follows: what is a mikdash me'at? What is a mikdash me'at? Lebate knishta. I will, instead of saying I will be for them a place of sanctity, the Targum interprets the verse as I will provide them with synagogues. I will provide them with shuls. De inun yatvin tanyin lebeit makdasha, or the Beit Makdasha. And they are only second only to the Beis HaMikdash. They will be a secondary status only to the Beis HaMikdash. This is not the simple, straightforward meaning of the verse. But clearly, Rashi and practically every single biblical interpreter in Ashkenaz interpreted the verse this way, meaning that even though I have sent them away in the nations and scattered them among the countries, nevertheless I will provide them with lesser sanctuaries. Rashi interprets synagogues, which are just a little bit less, inun tanyan, yatvin tanyan, to the Beis HaMikdash. Albeit, Rashi, the Targum, finds an echo in, or is quoted in the Gemara, that's source number two. Vahilem lemikdash ma'at, amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Notice, by the way, Rabbi Yitzchak is not a Babylonian, Rav Amora. He is an Eretz Yisraeli, Amora. Elu bate knesius ubate midrashos shebe bavel. This refers to synagogues and houses of study in Babylonia, or by extension throughout the Jewish world. Rabbi Lezer says, Zeh beis Rabbeinu shebebavel. This refers to the house of Rav, to the yeshiva of Rav in Babylonia. I would emphasize the fact, notice that Rashi says Bate Kneshta, and the Gemara adds the word Bate Medrash, yeshivas. Why didn't Rashi say Bate Medrash? Because in Franco Germany, there were no yeshiva buildings. Imagine, there were no building funds. The yeshivas were held, study was held in the shul. It's a multi-purpose building. Okay? So that's number one. The shul is identified as the Mikdash Me'at and understood to be an institution which is somewhat less than the Beis HaMikdash. The question then becomes, however, how serious are we to take this? Everybody knows it's a Mikdash Me'at. Everybody gets up and says, don't talk in shul, it's a Mikdash Me'at. Don't take your galoshes off before you come in when it's raining, it's a Mikdash Me'at. But the question is, what does that mean? How literally are we going to take that expression? Is it the Beis HaMikdash a substitute? A temporary substitute? Is the Beis HaKnesses, is the shul a substitute, a temporary substitute for the Beis HaMikdash? Or is it something more? Is it an emanation of the Beis HaMikdash? Does it participate in the same category, or is it something else? As we'll see, among the Ashkenazim, it was an extension of the Beis HaMikdash. For the Sfardim, at least judging from the Rambam, it occupies a separate category. How do I know? Very simply. Maimonides, when he discusses the rules governing the synagogue, puts them in the laws of tefillah. In other words, he talks about tefillah, 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 and he says that where should you have tefillah? In shul. It's a halacha in tefillah. When you look at the Ashkenazim, different ballgame. This is brought out in text number 3. Text number 3 comes from the Sefer Yireya Mashalem, which was written by Rabbi Elazar of Metz, who was one of the premier Talmidim of Rabbeinu Tam in the middle of the 12th century. On the question of the mitzvah, it's a book of a practical halacha, but it's organized according to the Taryag mitzvahs. When he counts the mitzvah of Mora HaMikdash, there is a mitzvah that when you go to the Beis HaMikdash, you have to comport yourself properly. You shouldn't talk Lashon. You shouldn't indulge the mitzvah of Lashon Hara. There's not a mitzvah of Lashon Hara. You should not indulge yourself in the Isser of Lashon Hara. You should comport yourself appropriately. Okay? There's such a din. And in fact, halacha lemaisa, those people who do go in Harabayit have an opportunity to, in fact, fulfill this mitzvah properly. You can't crack jokes when you're walking around Harabayit. You should, in fact, act appropriately. Okay? Notice how Rabbi Elazar of Metz, one of the major Balei HaTosfos, describes this mitzvah. Mora HaMikdash, V'yareisa me'elokecha, you should fear God. Siva bihikanesh adam la'migdash. The Torah is commanding, or God is commanding, that when a person goes into the temple, O beveis ha'kneses, O lebeis ha'medrash. Notice. Temple, shul, beis medrash. Don't ask me about beis medrash. I'm still wondering about it. She'yinhag behem mora v'kibud, that you should behave in a matter which befits awe and respect. And then, okay, we'll skip a little bit. Okay? Umatsinu, first he starts off to say you should be careful of the honor and respect of the Beis HaMikdash, and then he says, Umatsinu Beis HaKnesses uBeis HaMedrash Nikru'u Mikdash. They are also termed Mikdash. It's not simply a convenience. They have, if you want to use it in the yeshivish context, the shul has the halacha of Beis HaMikdash. Notice that the proper comportment, the laws guarding proper comportment in the synagogue are a subsection of the laws of the Beis HaMikdash. Okay? Again, to use Maimonides as a counter, the Rambam talks about proper comportment of the Beis HaMikdash in the shul, but again, in Hilchas Tefillah, the Rambam has the laws of proper comportment in the temple. Elsewhere, in Hilchas Bias HaMikdash, in Hilchas Beis HaBechira. But he doesn't put together the two. Because they're two separate categories. It's only convenience, it's a form of categorization, of description, but the shul is not the Beis HaMikdash. Interestingly, in the middle of the 13th century, around the year 1247, one of the leading Rabbanim in northern France, whose name was Rabbi Moshe ben Yaakov of Kusi, if anybody read A Distant Mirror by Barbara Tuchman about the 14th century in France, one of the leading characters there is Enguerrand of Coucy, who was the lord of the area, which 100 years later, 100 years earlier rather, Rav Moshe of Coucy, lived in. In any event, The Rav Moshe of Kusi wrote a sefer, wrote a book of halacha called the Sefer Mitzvos Gadol. The Sefer Mitzvos Gadol was the major source of halacha for French Jewry until deep into the 17th century. The book is simply a transcription of Maimonides with the addition of the rulings and the teachings of the Baalei HaTosfos. In other words, in a certain sense, the Sefer Mitzvos Gadol is like the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch has what? Has Reb Yosef Karo and Minhag Sfarad. And then the Ramah adds what the Ashkenazim do. This is in fact what, more or less, what Reb Moshe of Kusi did in the Sefer Mitzvos Gadol. He copies out the Rambam word for word in most places, and then adds what Rabbeinu Tam said and Rashi said and everybody else said in Ashkenaz. Okay? It's almost slavish. The Rambam is literally, it's mechanical. Except when it comes to this. He takes the rules of proper comportment in the synagogue, takes them out of Hilchas Tefillah where he found them in the Rambam, and put them in the laws of entering the Beis HaMikdash. Further confirmation of the fact that for Ashkenazim, the Shul is the Beis HaMikdash. Or 99% or 95% of the Beis HaMikdash. Things did not stop there. This identification of the Shul with the Beis HaMikdash found its expression in the way people acted in Shul. Take a look at number 4. This is a passage from Sefer Hasidim. Now Sefer Hasidim was written almost entirely by Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid in Regensburg. And for many, many years, it was considered to be sort of not reflective of reality, but rather what Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid thought should happen among Jews. Nowadays, we know that there is much of the book reflects what Ashkenazim did. And he would add his comments here and there. It's against that background I want to read the. I'd like to read this text. Okay? Hamechabed Beit HaKnesset. A person who. His job is to sweep the shul. Notice it's bad Hebrew. Hamechabed HaBeit Knesset. All right? That's not how you say it. In Hebrew, you say Hamechabed et Beit HaKnesset. What is. He was thinking in German. Okay? He's Hamechabed their synagogue. Okay? Very often, or debate the synagogue. Thank you. I admit I read German, but my spoken German is zerbrochen. In any event, hamechabed habeit knesset umotzi afar lachutz, and he's taking the dust out of the shul. He's whipping the shul. A note zarich lishtachavot. On his way out, he doesn't have to prostrate himself. Doesn't have to bow. Shareksiv, because it says, Hishtachmul Hashem Bahadras Kodesh, that when you bow to God in the glory of sanctity. Okay? And taking out the garbage, or taking out the dustpan, that's not exactly dignified. Aval kishikvar hotzio lechutz, but when he takes out the garbage and he goes back in to put away the broom and he's going to leave again, Yishtachaveh. He should bow down and prostrate himself facing the ark. Ve'od, furthermore, there's another reason to exempt this guy who's clean, the janitor of the shul, to clean, not to bow. Ha'osek ba'mitzvah patur min ha'mitzvah. He's doing a mitzvah by cleaning the shul. It's like they tell the story about the tzaddik of the Yerushalayim tzaddik, Rabbi Levin, that he once met. He bumped into a street sweeper in Yerushalayim, and he said, "I envy you." And the street sweeper said, "You envy me, Rebbe?" He says, "Yeah, you have the opportunity to clean and to maintain the holy city. It's a tremendous chus." Okay. So he said, "It's a mitzvah, clean the shul." Vimholech acharei. Okay. And so therefore, it's another reason not to make him bow while he's cleaning. Vimholech acharei beis hakneses. And if he walks behind the shul, he still has to bow at the threshold, at biftan ashar. How do you know? Or the courtyard. Uksiv, and he quotes a pasuk in Yechezkel, Vishtachvu ama'aretz pesach ashar hahu b'shabasos v'chadoshim l'fnei Hashem. That the people on the Harabayis should, when they're standing at the gate in front of the shul, in front of the temple, they should bow down on Shabbos and on Rosh Chodesh in, before God. Why before God? Because what's in the Beis HaMikdash? The Shechina. All right? Lest you think that in fact, he's just using this verse as some kind of a proof text. It's a direct reference, number 5, to Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer, which is an Eretz Israeli medrash, which talks about life in Eretz Israel. Se'ama Rabbi Yehuda, number 5, B'chodashim u'v'shabbatot Yisrael yoshvim sham, on Shabbos and Yontif, the people will go to Har HaBayit, they sit there, v'ro'im et adalt et latot niftachim me'aleihem, and they would see the gates open on their own, v'yodin sh'shchinoso sh'alakadosh baruch hu sham, and they would know that God's presence is there. Shenemar ki Hashem Elokei Yisrael babo miyad babo. You know that God's presence is there. Miyad korim u'mishtachim lifnei ha'elokim. Immediately, as soon as the gates open, they bow down and they knees and they bow. V'chein l'sha'avar v'chein l'hasid. And so, and similarly, it happened in the past, and so it will be in the future when the Beis Hamikdash, Yivana Beis Hamikdash b'mehera b'yameinu, shenemar v'hishtachlu ama'aretz pesach hashar ha'u b'shabbosus v'chadoshim. Exact same verse. Okay. That's not an accident. Rabbi Yehuda Chassid is here directly referring to that medrash, which many people knew, because Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer was a well-known medrash in Ashkenaz. Okay. We don't do that anymore. But people, and in fact, if you ask somebody, where do you bow down when you go into shul, when you go into someplace, they'll say, the Beis HaMikdash. But here it was an understood that when you walk into shul, why? Because the shul is the Beis HaMikdash minus. Okay. And lest you ask, you could ask, okay, maybe this is one of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid's innovations. Notice the way he writes. He writes as follows. He's talking about, the point of this paragraph is to show that a person who's the janitor of the shul doesn't have to bow. He takes it for granted, that's the chiddush. He takes it for granted that the average person goes into shul or passes the shul and he bows down. Now whether he gets down on his hands and knees or whether he just bows like that from the waist is irrelevant. This is a society where you feel when you walk into shul you have to bow. It gives another twist or another dimension to a pasuk that we don't even say, most people don't even say when they walk into shul, even though it's in the siddur, Vani barov chasdecha avol beitecha, eshtachava el heichal kodshecha biyirasecha. Nobody says it. But it's there. Somebody said it. And we know that Ashkenazim at that time said everything in the siddur. They didn't skip anything. I don't know if they said it fast or said it slow. That's another story. Okay? So, the idea that the shul is the temple found practical expression. People are bowing. But it doesn't stop there. Number 6. This is a statement, the Sefer HaPardes. All right, so bowing is very nice. What was the unique about the Beis HaMikdash? That in order to walk in, you had to be in a certain specific state. What kind of state? You had to be in a state of ritual purity. You had to be tahor. Okay. In number 6, we have a statement by Rashi in the Sefer HaPardes, where he says as follows, a very famous statement. V'yesh nashim, there are women, shenimnaot milikanes b'veta kneset b'nidutan u'miligava sefer. There are contemporary women who, when they are nidot, or when they're yoldot, by the way, after they had a baby, who don't go into shul and they don't touch a Sefer Torah. Rashi's response is, chumra ba'almahu. It's a unnecessary. It's just stama chumra. Ve'einan tzrichen la'asos kein. And they don't have to do that. Dematam heino sefer. Why would you do that? If they really think that the Beis HaKnesset is the shul, and the shul is the Beis HaMikdash rather, then afilu achar tvilo lama nichnasos bo. Because even if you go to mikveh, they shouldn't go to the shul, because in order, if you, a person was a nida, or a person was a zava, or a person had other kinds of tumah, they also have to bring special korbanos to go into the Beis HaMikdash. So you should never be able to go to shul. Until you bring your karbanis, you can't go in even at the mikveh. So you can never go to a woman, can never go to shul. And if it's not the base of mikdash, then you should be able to go in, tikansu. But the men are no better than the women. We're tamei meis, tamei sheretz, and tamei keri. We didn't mention keri here. Interesting. We'll get in a minute. Halamadata. You learn from this that the shul does not have halacha beis hamikdash in this regard. V'yecholos likanes, and they can go in. Aval. He does a quick about face and says makom tara lahen v'yafa osos. Vyashrayan. They attribute the need for purity to the shul. It's good. Keep the minig. And the minig maintained itself until, in fact, some places, the modern era. And men, we'll get to the men. Okay? So in other words, Rashi might have had a problem on a purely theoretical point of view, but it is clear that the popular conception was that a woman should not go into shul until she goes to mikveh, because you can't walk into shul because it's the base of mikdash, and therefore you have to go to mikveh. Okay, so you'll say, why is this restricted to the women? Rashi says, no, the men are no better. The answer is that in many ways, the men also accepted this idea. Number one. If a man has relations with his wife, say, then he becomes tamei as well. And if he goes to the base of mikdash, he has to go to mikveh as well. Okay, that's why all men before they go to Tarabayas have to go to mikveh. Whether the requirement of going to mikveh before davening still obtains or not is a matter of debate. In Ashkenaz, there was far more sympathy for the need that men should, in fact, go to mikveh before they do so. But that's one aspect. Notice, however, number seven. Number seven comes from a very interesting book that was written around the same time as these other sources that we've seen around the mid-12th century. It was written by Rabbi Yaakov of Mervej, who was actually from Provence, but he reflects here Ashkenazic usage. He was a person who never stopped learning, even when he slept. And he used to have dreams, and that a malach came to him, and he would answer all of his shilas. And he collected all of the answers in a collection called Shelot Tshuvot Min Hashamayim. This book caused some consternation among poskim because there's a general principle lo b'shamayim that heaven's not allowed to intervene in all kinds of halachic disputes. We'll leave that aside. What's interesting in this regard is what he says. His name was Rabbi Yaakov of Mervej, M-E-R-V-E, accent grave, G-E. All right? Ve'od nistapaknu. He says, I have a question. We had a question. Al tfilas balkriyin. Whether before a balkeri can daven, does he have to go to mikveh? Because the Gemara says in Brachas, bitlum l'tfilusa k'Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira, because according to the Gemara, the tfila that was required by Ezra for a balkeri before he studied Torah, okay, was abolished or was stopped or was reinterpreted, whatever you want to say, however you read the Gemara, okay? But that was for Talmud Torah. There is no explicit statement that the going to mikveh before davening for a man who had relations or had a seminal emission, that was abolished, okay? And he says, what about letting, and then in the part that I didn't bring, the Rabbi Yaakov Mervej had a question. What about, forget about the individual. Can you let a person, a guy who was tamei as a balkeri, can you let him daven for the yamid? Can you let him be a shliach tzibur? Notice what the answer is. The malach comes and says, Veheshivu from heaven, Vavadatem et Hashem Elokechem harvei omer ze tfilo, Ve'efshir tamei makriv korban. The prayer service has the same halacha as the avoda in the Beis HaMikdash. And as a result, just like a Kohen who is Tameh can't offer a sacrifice, you should not let a person who's Tameh offer up a prayer. All right? Why? Because the service, this is one step further, it's not just the building is Beis HaMikdash, the service which takes place there is avoda in the Beis Hamikdash sense, and therefore the Kohen has got to go to mikvah first. Okay. Now I didn't bring the source here. In an article that I published in a volume in honor of my dear friend and colleague, Rabbi Professor Yitzhak Zimmer, who used to teach yeshiva, used to teach history at yeshiva, and was the rabbi, I think, of Beis Medrash HaGadol on Fort Washington Avenue, until he made Aliyah in 1970. Of course, nobody here is old enough to remember that. In a volume that just came out, I quoted another source, which is even more mind-boggling. It appears, I'll start this way, according to pure halacha, Kohanim should duchen every single day, everywhere in the world. There is no reason whatsoever, al pidin, for a Kohen not... I know the Rav felt differently, but in terms of the straight shot in the Gemara, there is absolutely no reason why a Kohen should not duchen every day. On the contrary, we know that throughout the Middle Ages, in southern France and in North Africa, they were duchening every single day. The Persians to this day duchen every single day. Other places in Europe, they duchen on Shabbos and Chagim, and Shabbos as well as Chagim. Only among the Ashkenazim did this business happen, the only duchen on Yontif. What happened? Where does it come from? I argue, and I believe this is true, I hope I've proved it, that in fact the reason is because they maintained, that duchening is also a form of avoda. And a Kohen should go to mikvah before he does it. Except that in Northern Europe, for those of you who've been there, it's cold. And as opposed to the new fancy schmancy mikveh I read about in the paper on Shabbos in New Rochelle, the mikvehs, it's cold in Northern Europe. And the water is freezing. So Benos Yisrael HaChasudos VaTzadikos HaTzidkanios, they break the ice in the mikveh and they did what they did. But the Kohanim, as medavnish, medavnish. If you don't have to, you don't have to. So they actually were mevatel a mitzvah's essay min haTorah because they were convinced that you needed to go to mikvah before you duchened. So what happened, Yontif? The minig was, because going to shul was a kiyum in Aliyah L'Regel, a pilgrimage, everybody went to mikvah Erev Yontif. So if already went to mikveh, Erev Yontif, and Erev Sukkos, and Erev Pesach, and Erev Shavuos, it's not so bad, it's not, you know, Hanukkah, okay, or Purim, since they were already Tahor, so then they would duchen. That's the historical basis for that minig. Again, based on the presumption that what goes on in the synagogue is avoda, that Birkas Kohanim is avoda, and it requires Taharas Haguf, and therefore, not just washing your hands, and therefore, if you don't go to mikvah, no duchen. Next. Okay, so what have we seen? We've seen that the idea that the shul is the Beis HaMikdash, that the shul is the Beis HaMikdash, actually expresses itself in bowing and in the application of many rules of Tumah and Tahara to the shul. In number 8, we have something from a different angle. This is a passage from the Maharil. The Maharil, Rabbi Yaakov Halevi, actually lived after the period of classical Ashkenaz. He died in 1427. He and his Rebbeim were responsible for actually recreating and reconstructing the communities of Germany after many of them were wiped out during the attacks of the Black Plague in 1348-49. He spent much of his time, tremendous gadol, but he spent much of his time collecting and collating minhagim so that people can, in fact, go back to the customs of their families. One of the things, by the way, that he did was also to canonize the Nusach HaTfila of Ashkenaz. Okay, so for example, he's the one that put the, seal of approval on the way that everybody says Kol Nidre, with all the da 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 da. Okay, da 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 da. That's his old, it's probably even older. In any event, he tells the following story. Amar Mahari Segal said, Rabbi Yaakov, he was a Levi, Rabbi Yaakov HaLevi, said the following. At the time that he lived, there were two major centers of Ashkenazic Jews. Jews had already been thrown out of France. There were no Jews in France. There were no Jews in England. We've been thrown out of wonderful places. But the Jewish community in Germany was of the Ashkenazim was actually divided into two centers. Center number one was the Rhineland, where they'd always been, Mainz, Speyer, Worms, Köln, Regensburg, you name it. And the other was Austria, Vienna, when they weren't thrown out of there. Most importantly, a town about 20 minutes outside of Vienna called Wiener Neustadt, and towns are in the area, some towns southern in the southern Czech Republic. There's the town of Brünn, which is known as Bruna in the Makorot. In any event, so there were two different variations on Minhagim among Ashkenazim. There was called Minhag Ostreich, Austria, and Minhag Rhinus of the Rhineland. Ein derech b'nei Ostreich. It is not the custom of the Jews in Austria. Shatzibur melavin ha'avil ebeso b'shabes shebezayim b'shivas ayonim. The minhag is not to accompany the avil home from shul during shiva. Those are those who actually argue, since an avil requires shmira, so there are those who actually accompany the avil when he would go home. But Shabbos is the shom, is the shmira itself. So that's all. Okay. V'yafim, but he prefers, he says, v'yafim minig b'nei Rhinus. Okay, and he likes the fact that in the Rhineland they in fact did accompany the avil home. He shouldn't be alone. Shenoagim kach, they follow that practice. Al pi maharam. They follow that practice based on the teachings of Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, Rabbi Rutenberg. The derech nechamahu. It's a way of being consoling, of being there for the person. Okay? However, the Jews of Austria, they have their own einfall, they have their own practice, which is also very nice. Yoshvim imo bechatzer beis haknesses. They sit in the courtyard of the shul. Kifisha Noah Gosim Gam Kem B'nei Rhinus. In other words, the Jews of Rhineland and the Jews of Austria sit with the Ovel, sit with the mourner Lo Aleinu in the courtyard of the shul before they leave. The Amar, okay, and he reported, Ma'aril reported, Sheshama Mirabo Ma'amarash, that he heard from his Rebbe, Rab Shalom of Wiener Neustadt, okay, Kishenifrad Azmin Ha'Ovel Haya Omer, the Rab Shalom of Neustadt, the Godel Ador in the period immediately after the Black Plague, would say to the mourners in the Chatzar Beit HaKnesset in Wiener Neustadt, Misha Shiken Shemo Babayas Hazeh Hu Yinachemcha. He who has caused his Shechina to indwell in this house, may he comfort you. Okay? Now, that line also comes from Pirkei the Rebbe Lezer. And it describes the fact that in the Beit HaMikdash there were three gates. There was the main gate. On one side was the gate for chasanim, where they would welcome the chasanim who would come together after they got married. And then another gate for people who were avelim and people who were excommunicated. And in that gate, they would console the mourners and say, Misha shikein shemo babayis hazeh hu yinachemcha. He who has caused his shechina to indwell in his house, may he comfort you. But in the Beis HaMikdash, it makes sense. By the way, those of you who have been to perhaps to Bir Am, in northern Israel, and have seen the remains of the shul, you see that there too, there are three gates. That's based on the Beis HaMikdash. Okay? So it's also this business of Mishi Shiket Shemo Babai Sezei Hu Yirachemcha, that the Shechina should console you in the Beis HaMikdash makes sense. But they asked him, when Reb Shalom of Neustadt, the Godel Ador, said this, the people in the shul said, Vishalu, Mashikin Shemo Shaykh Beis HaKnesset Shalana, what's the Shechina and the Shikin Shemo got to do with our shul? The Ha'ika B'Midrash. Okay, and then he talks about the three gates. The Heishivlo, and Reb Shalom of Neustadt said, De Beis HaKnesses Mikdash Me'at. So it's not just how you act. The shul has the Shechina in it. It is the Beis HaMikdash. Of course, without the Shechina, why would there be a Beis HaMikdash? Now, so I hope I've shown you that in fact the shul was Beis HaMikdash, or Beis HaMikdash minor, you know, second only to Beis HaMikdash. Now I'd like to ask you a question. I raise the question, who lives there? In light of the comment of Reb Shalom of Neustadt in this established minhag, by the way, this minhag is attested of saying Misha Shiken Shemo Babayis Zehu Yinachemcha in shul to the Shabbos evening to the on Leil Shabbos to the Avelim is attested to in Germany and I'm pretty sure in France all the way back certainly to the time of Rashi. This is an old Ashkenazi minhag. Okay. How tangible, how vivid, how immediate was the sense of the Shechina in shul, and how did it find expression? The answer evidently is very. Okay. Look at, for example, number nine, the Gemara talks about the choreography of prayer. It's Gemara in Yuma. Tanya Nami Hachi, we learned in a Braisa. Hamispailel Tzarech Shiafsia Shalosh Psios Le'achorav. When you finish davening Shemoneh Esrei, you take 3 steps backwards. V'charkach Yitein Shalom, and then you say, go, goodbye. V'im Lo Asakein, and if you don't do that, Roy Lo Shalo Hispailel. It's better you shouldn't have davened than to be chatzuf, than to be arrogant in front of God, impudent in front of God. Umishum Shmaya Amru, Shmaya as in Shmaya V'Avtalion, in the name of Shmaya they said, Shenosin Sholom Limin, V'Charkach L'Smol, first you bow to the right, then you bow to the left, Shenamar Mimino Eshtas Lamo, V'Omer Yipol Mitzidcha Elef Urvava Miminech. Why do you act that way? Says Rashi, next page. How do you bow? Says the Gemara. Right and left is God's right and your left. So we know that we go like this and like this and like this, right? Dehi yamino shel kodesh baruchu shemispalel roa atzmo keilu shchina lemul panav shenamar shavisi Hashem lenegdi tamim. The shchina is literally there. Now you could argue. Ke'ilu might be something of a hedge, okay? I would accept that. Let's see what time it is. Let's hold that off for a minute, okay? Now, I would argue, in fact, that it's not that way. Take a look at number 12. We're going to skip 12. We're going to skip the double 11 and jump to 12. The Mishnah says as follows in Megillah. Kohen sheyesh biyadav mumim lo yises kapav. If a Kohen has deformities on his hands, he should not duchen. This is before the Kohanim used to put the talis over their hands. Reb Yehuda Omer, af mishahayu yadav tzvuos satis lo yises kapav b'fnei sha'am mistak libo. Even if a guy has stained hands from the work that he does, he shouldn't duchen because the people look at his hands and they'll look at his hands. Why is that? Rashi says as follows. Kohen sheyesh biyadav mumin, lefisha am mistaklimbo, the people look at it. Okay? So what's the problem? Vamrinan b'maseches chagiga, and the Gemara says in chagiga, ha-mistakil b'kohenim b'sha shenosim es kapeyam einav kehos, lefisha shchina shora al yedehen. If you look at the Kohanim when they're duchening, okay, you will end up looking at the Shechina and you will go blind, or you will lose your eyesight. Okay? Lefisha Shechina Shora al Yedehem. So Tosfos and Chagiga and everybody else starts yelling and screaming, what is he talking about? We're not talking about the Beis HaMikdash. We're talking about Shul. What's a Shechina and Shul? On and on. So Tosfos and Chagiga at the end says, Ela Mishum Hesech Adas Enem Mistakel V'lo Maschene Datoy. So he says the reason why you shouldn't look is because you'll be distracted by the fact that this is a Kohen who has problems with his hands. You'll be distracted by the fact that his hands are stained. You won't concentrate. You won't have the kavanah. Right? Kavanah is to don't look at the hands of the Kohen. It's based on Yerushalmi. Very nice. My question is not with Tosfos. The question is Rashi. Rashi knew the other alternative explanation. Whether he knew the Yerushalmi, I'm not sure. Because the Yerushalmi wasn't available to everybody all the time. Tosfos quotes Yerushalmi a lot more than Rashi. However, the logic of it is clear. You can all say it's distracting. So, and Rashi didn't know that the Gemara was talking about the Mesa Mikdash and not about shuls in France. But nevertheless, that's how he interprets. He assumes the veritable presence of the Shechina in shul when the Kohanim duchen. Interestingly, I just found this out last week, a colleague of mine, Dr. Aaron Arend, put out a critical edition of Rashi's commentary on Megillah. And he notes that in one of the manuscripts, after Rashi's comment, it says, of course, this only refers to the Beis HaMikdash. It can't refer to Shul. It can only refer to Hesach Hadas, our distraction. Says Dr. Arend, rightly so, this cannot be Rashi. It's a later manuscript. Somebody was so bothered by Rashi's statement that he wanted to make sure that you don't get the wrong idea. All of the other manuscripts of Rashi, all the other quotations of Rashi have Rashi this way. The Shechina is in Shul. And if literally in Shul, and that's why you don't look the Kohanim's hands. Right? Now, Tosfos may have said, don't get distracted. But we all know, growing up, that the reason you don't look at the Kohanim is because the Shechina is there and you might lose your eyesight. Now, the Shechina is veritably there. Take a look. How do I know it's not just Rashi, by the way, but that all Ashkenazim felt that way? Because in number 14, we have a statement by Rabbi Lezer ben Natan of Mainz, the Ravon, who was younger than Rashi, but he spent his life, one of the functions of his book was to preserve the traditions of Ashkenaz, and he says as follows. He quotes Rabbi Yehuda, and he says straight, without any qualifications, Rabbi Yehuda omer af mi sheyadav tzvuos satis kadve, he has the word in German, mipnei sha'ola mistaklim bo, v'amrinan ha-mistakil ba-kohanim, kishenosim yideyim einav kehos, l'fisha shechina shora bein kishrei eitz ba-osav. He wasn't learning kutchin. He wasn't learning theoretical halacha. This is a book for practical halacha, act, how to act and why to act in shul. So Rashi, so the Ravon confirms Rashi's position. The final source. We'll go back to number 10. The final source is from the Rokeach. The Rokeach was written by Rabbi Elazar of Worms. He was the final leader of the group called Hasidi Ashkenaz. But again, in much of his book, he simply reflects common practice and common belief among Ashkenazi Jews. He talks about bringing back the Torah. He quotes Rabbi Chizkia. Rabbi Chizkia was the brother of the Ravon. And he talks about people bowing down towards the Sefer Torah when they bring the Sefer Torah back to the Ark after Kriyas Torah before Musaf, or before the Drasha. They didn't have Drashas then. Okay? Shul got out much earlier. No, actually maybe not. Okay? And you look at the last two lines. Alright? Uma kishemachzirim osa omer yalucha lo diacha shelo bishvil elokus shebatorah hu mishtachve. You don't bow towards the Torah because, God forbid, the Torah is not God. Ela la kodesh borchu hu mishtachve sheshchinoso shora alav. The Shechina indwells literally in the synagogue. I would argue that that is a transformative way of looking at shul, at tefillah, and at the act of simply being in the presence of God. If you assume that the Shechina is not just echoed in shul, but is present in shul, the rest of it all makes sense. Ve'ehi lahem le'mikdash me'at means that I will make little batei mikdash everywhere. And it's as if you were already in Yerushalayim. Maybe yeah, maybe no. I'd like to suggest something a little bit different. There is a machlokas, there's always a machlokas. My kids always like to say that when my kids ask me a shayla or a question, They say, okay, but just don't tell me it's a machlokas rishonim. It's usually true, but that's not an answer. Okay, look at number 10. There are two opinions in the Gemara and Yevamos as to what posture of prayer should you adopt vis-a-vis your eyes when you pray. Rabbi Chiya, Rabbi Shimon bar Rabbi Havu Yasvi. This is in Eretz Yisrael. Also, Rabbi Chiya, Rabbi Shimon, the son of Rabbi Yudah Nasi, were sitting. Pasachad Menayhu. And one of them opened, we don't remember who said what, but one of them opened his mouth and said, V'omar mispalil tzarech sheyitein einav lamata. person who prays should look down. Shenemar, v'hayu einai v'libi sham kol hayamim. Your eyes and your heart should be there all of the days. It's Shlomo Melech discussing the Beis Hamikdash. V'chad amar, and the other one said, einav l'mala, you should look up. How do you know? Nisalav aveinu el kapayim, el Hashem b'shamayim. We raise up our hearts on wings to the heavens, to God in heaven. Adahachi, in the middle of this discussion, also Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Yossi legabayu. Rabbi Yossi sat himself down and came in and said, "What are you talking about? Amar lahu b'masikdu. What are you discussing? Amrulah b'tfila. We're talking about hilchas tefila. Amar lahu kachamar Abba. My father, Rabbi Yossi, said, Hamispalal tzarch shi'itein enav lemato v'libo lemalo kedei shi'iskaimu shnei mikros halalu." Says, my father held that you should actually look down physically, and your heart should soar up in order to be able to fulfill the dictates of both of these psukim. Okay? And in fact, that's exactly the compromise of Rabbi Shmuel. Rabbi Yossi was exactly what was accepted halakha l'maisa. Take a look at Siddur Rashi, which is just a version of Machzor Vitri. He says, "Dechimatzli yiten anpoi ba'ara." When you daven, you should look down, put your face down. Uli be'larakia, and your heart should soar up to heaven. To Amr Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Yossi, and he quotes that gemara. That's not, however, what Rashi says in the Perush on the Gemara. He says, "Einav lamata, you should look down," not because of humility or anything like that. He literally, and which is the way other Rishonim understand it, but rather, or maybe because the Shechina is there. But rather, v'hayu eini v'libi sham kol hayomim, that my eyes and my heart will be there all of the days. Rashi says, you should look down. Why? Klapei Eretz Yisrael. Mishum deshchina hasam kaima, kedichsiv v'hayu eini v'libi sham. You should look down because you look down because you should look towards Eretz Yisrael. That's where the Shechina is. And that fits the pasuk, because the pasuk, as you know, in the tefillah of Shlomo Melech, he says that all tefillahs should start wherever they are, but they should go up to heaven through the Beis Hamikdash, because that's Shara Shemayim, and that's why we have the din of Kivun Hamikdash. When you daven, you should face east, or you should face south. I face north at home, because I live south of Yerushalayim, and so on, because all prayers go up through the Beis Hamikdash. My question is, Rashi explicitly says the Shechina is in Shul. So why do you have to look towards the Beis Hamikdash on the assumption that the Shechina is there? The answer would seem to be as follows. Okay? Rashi in the 11th century, even before there was the internet, was aware of the concept of the portal. The portal, for those of you who are not heavy into Facebook and the internet, or you don't need to be on Facebook to be on the internet, but a portal is an entree to someplace else. All right? Anthropologists of religion, of medieval religion, have argued, and I think this is exactly what's going on here, okay, have argued that basically, there were key places, and there were subsidiary places. Jews who went into Shul, the real place is the Beis Hamikdash. The Shechina is only in the Beis Hamikdash. However, the Shul was an extension of the Beis Hamikdash. The Shul was a portal to the Beis Hamikdash. When you went into Shul, you were in the Beis Hamikdash. And that's why your kavanah should be towards the Beis Hamikdash, because that's really, you're transported there when you walk into Shul. Now that sounds like Drush. However, I wouldn't even need to bring the anthropologist, because Rav Soloveitchik argued something similar. One of the themes, I mean, I remember him saying it many, many times in public drushes. Those public drushes are now being published. On many occasions, the Rav noted that the Jewish sense of time is different than the Western sense of time. I mean, as a person who is very conscious of Jewish time, I'm not talking about weddings starting an hour and a half late. Our sense of time is the fact that there is no past. The past is not dead for us. The past is living for us. Just as in the Haggadah it says, "Bechol dor vador chai vadom lerosas atzmo kilu yatzta mimitzrayim," that's not just a song. When you are at the Seder, you are yotze mimitzrayim. In Out of the Whirlwind, the Rav notes that in the first kina, or the second kina, after Eicha, the Paitan, the author of the kina, talks about Belel ze yivkayu. On this night we cry. On this night we cry not because we remember, but on this night we cry because we experience the Beis Hamikdash being destroyed now. That's true of all of the regalim. On Pesach we are yotzei mimitzrayim, literally. On Sukkot we are wandering in the desert, literally. And the best proof of the fact is that we stay up all night and we are mekabel the Torah again. Everybody quotes the Rashi. B'yom hazeh ba'o mi ba'sinai. The Torah is being given right this second. Okay, that's as far as time is concerned. It is evidently true that the same kind of contraction of time is also true geographically. Jews throughout the ages, in a very profound sense, never left Eretz Israel. They may have lived in France and Germany and Morocco and Spain and everywhere else. They never left Eretz Israel. One of the striking facts of Jewish history is that with all of that, there is not one complaint ever uttered that the non-Jews didn't have a right to expel us from various places, because everybody agreed that we don't belong in France and Germany and Morocco or Italy or wherever the case might be. But it's more than that. The entire Luach HaShanah, all the regalim, organize your life around living in Israel and not where you are. We just read through Tu B'Shvat. Okay? There's no Shkediot Porchot in New York. I lived here long enough. Or in Boston, where I grew up, certainly. Your life is organized around there. I would argue, and I mean this, I would argue that Al Pidin, Rashi and the Tosfos and the Chachmei Ashkenaz would argue the same thing is true of the shul. When you go into the shul, you are in an extension of the Beis Hamikdash. The Shechina is here. You bow down because the Shechina is here. But not just because the Shechina is here, but because where you are is no longer in Mainz and Worms and Köln and Regensburg and Troyes and Ramerud and Evreux and London and York. You're in the Beis Hamikdash. I think that, I hope, I know that once this all came together for me, it transformed the way that I mean, I don't bow down when I bring the shul. But it transformed not just my attitude towards the shul building, but toward who and what are in that building and what you should do when you're there. And it made the expression Shavisi Hashem Lenegdi Tamid, it revived for me based on the words of my ancestors and our ancestors. Transformed, intensified, and elevated the act of prayer in shul to one that is far more sublime and one that absolutely militates against any kind of rote. Because if it's a bimkom, if it's a substitute, then you can get away with mumbling and not paying attention. But if the Shechina is shruya, if the Shechina indwells in the shul, who could possibly mumble when offering up one's tefillot? Thank you very much.